Hello and welcome to our quarterly podcast about activities to support consistent application. And this podcast covers the quarter to March 2021. I'm Petrina Buchanan, a member of the ISB's technical staff, and I'm here today with Sue Lloyd, Vice Chair of the Board and Chair of the Interpretations Committee. And we're again recording this podcast remotely, so fingers crossed that technology is our friend. So I'm going to start with the Interpretations Committee meetings that took place in February and March. And at these meetings, the committee discussed six topics. Now, for one of these topics, configuration or customization costs in a cloud computing arrangement, the committee decided to finalize the agenda decision. And the board will discuss that topic at its meeting in April. And that's in accordance with the new requirement in the due process handbook for the board to decide whether it objects to the agenda decision before it's published. So we're going to cover that in our next podcast for the quarter to June 2021. So nothing on cloud computing in this podcast, but it is a really interesting topic. So this is now my advertisement for you all to tune in next time. Now to another topic, sale and leaseback of an asset in a single asset entity, the committee decided not to finalise the agenda decision, having considered the comment letters received on the tentative agenda decision. And I think maybe it's worth spending a few minutes explaining why. So why did the committee not finalise the agenda decision, having published a tentative agenda decision on the topic? So the fact pattern is one in which a subsidiary holds only one asset, a building, and it has no liabilities. So this subsidiary is truly a single asset entity. And the parent enters into a transaction to sell all of the shares in the subsidiary and at the same time lease back the building owned by the subsidiary for a period of time. And the submitter asked about the gain to be recognised on the transaction. So would the parent recognise the full gain on the sale, as required by IFRS 10 when a parent loses control of a subsidiary, or if it's applying the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16, would it recognise only the amount of the gain that relates to the rights transferred to the buyer lessor? So that's sort of the partial gain recognition model in the sale and leaseback requirements. So this question was really overall actually about the interaction between the loss of control requirements in IFRS 10 and the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16. And that's really because the transaction actually fits within both sets of requirements. So the question really was which gain recognition requirement should the entity apply? Now, in the tentative agenda decision, the committee had concluded that the entity applies both sets of requirements. First, the requirements for a loss of control of a subsidiary in IFRS 10, and then the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16. And the outcome of that would be that the entity would recognise only the amount of the gain that relates to the rights transferred to the third party buyer. So the gain would be consistent with the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16. Now, some of the comment letters received highlighted that the fact pattern in the tentative agenda decision was really very narrow. And in practice, it's more often the case that the subsidiary would hold more than one asset and it might involve a business. Or it could even also be the case that the parent wouldn't sell all of its shares in the subsidiary. So respondents asked whether the outcome would be the same in those more common situations. And discussing those comments received, the committee's conclusion was that it wouldn't be possible to discuss this narrow fact pattern submitted in isolation of any other transaction that involved the sale of a subsidiary and a leaseback. So in other words, because the question was about the interaction between the requirements in IFRS 10 and IFRS 16, the committee couldn't provide an answer for the fact pattern submitted without also as a consequence providing an answer for all of those other sales of subsidiaries with a leaseback. And so the committee decided that to finalise the agenda decision that would explain the application of the standards to all such transactions would create a risk of adding or changing IFRS requirements, which of course an agenda decision cannot do. So it therefore decided to recommend to the board that it undertake narrow scope standard setting in this topic. And so that's something the board will consider at a future meeting. So now I'm going to move on to the tentative agenda decisions. And Sue, I'm going to ask you to talk through the submission on IS2 about the definition of net realisable value.
Okay, so to put this in context, this was a question about how to measure inventories. And listeners will probably know that IAS2 requires inventories to be measured at the lower of cost and net realisable value. And in IAS2, net realisable value is defined as the estimated selling price less the estimated costs of completion and the estimated costs necessary to make the sale. And the question the committee received was about that last part of the definition of net realisable value. What are the estimated costs necessary to make the sale? And when you determine net realisable value, does an entity include all the costs necessary to make the sale or only those that are incremental to the sale? So the committee concluded, I think, on a very specific point and noted in the tentative agenda decision that IAS2 does not allow an entity to limit the costs included to only those that are incremental to the sale. If costs were limited in this way, an entity could potentially exclude costs that it must incur to sell the inventory, but that isn't incremental to a particular sale. Now, unlike other standards like IAS 36 or IFRS 5, IAS2 doesn't state that an entity includes only incremental costs. Instead, it requires an entity to estimate the costs necessary to make the sale in the ordinary course of business and uses judgment to determine those costs considering its specific facts and circumstances, including the nature of the inventories that are being measured.
So that's a tentative agenda decision that was out for comment until the middle of April, together with another tentative agenda decision that relates to IS1 and IS10. So again, Sue, I'm going to ask you to cover that one.
Okay, so in this case, the question that we got was about a situation where an entity is no longer a going concern. And the submitter asked two questions. So the first is whether the entity can prepare financial statements on a going concern basis for prior periods when it was a going concern in those periods, but by the time it prepares the financial statements for those periods, it is no longer a going concern. And on that question, the committee said no. If the entity is no longer a going concern when it gets to preparing the financial statements, it can't prepare those financial statements on a going concern basis, despite the situation in the prior periods. And this is based on paragraph 14 of IAS 10, which says that an entity shall not prepare its financial statements on a going concern basis if management has determined after the reporting period that the entity is no longer a going concern. Now, the second question that we got was about whether an entity restates comparative information when it first prepares financial statements on a non-going concern basis. And for that question, we did some research and that identified no diversity in application. Entities don't restate comparative information. So there was no evidence, subject of course to what we hear in the comment letters, that the question has widespread effect. So the tentative agenda decision basically just reflects that observation for that.
Great, thank you, Sue. So now I'll move on to the two tentative agenda decisions published in March. And the first of those relates to non-refundable value-added tax, VAT, on lease payments. And the fact pattern is such that VAT is charged on goods and services in this jurisdiction, and buyers of those goods and services are typically able to recover any VAT paid from the government. However, because of the nature of an entity's operations, the entity can recover only a portion of the VAT it pays on purchasing goods and services. And that actually includes the amounts it pays for leases. So it's only able to recover a portion of the VAT that it pays on its invoice, that it pays on its leases. Now, the submitter asked whether that entity includes any non-refundable VAT on lease payments as part of what it considers to be the lease payments for the lease when applying IFRS 16. Or instead, does it otherwise consider the non-refundable VAT to be a separate tax expense? Now, in this topic, again, we conducted outreach, and what that outreach told us was that it really provided limited evidence that non-refundable VAT and lease payments is actually material to affected lessees, and also provided evidence of diversity and the way that lessees in similar circumstances account for that non-refundable VAT. So again, the committee had no evidence when it discussed in March that the question would have widespread effect. Now, Sue, maybe you can cover the second tentative agenda decision published in March.
Sure, an FI question, so always keen to do those. So this question related to the application of IAS 32 to warrants issued by an entity. And in the question, the warrant provides the holder with the right to buy a fixed number of the issuer's equity instruments for an exercise price that will be fixed at a future date. And that means that on initial recognition, the issuer classifies the warrant as a financial liability because of the variability in the exercise price at the date of initial recognition, which means that the fixed for fixed condition in IAS 32 can't be met. Now, the submitter asked whether the issuer reclassifies the warrants as equity instruments once the warrant's exercise price is fixed, subsequent to initial recognition, in the way that is specified in the contract. Now, the committee noted that IAS 32 contains no general requirements for reclassifying financial liabilities and equity instruments after initial recognition when the contractual terms are unchanged. And it also noted that similar questions about the need to think again about the classification of warrants can arise in other circumstances. In addition to that, reclassification by the issuer of warrants has been identified as one of the practice issues that the board is going to consider in the FICE project. So given all of that, the committee concluded that the board should consider the question asked as part of its broader discussions on the FICE project, and that this particular question would be too narrow to address in isolation. So again, a tentative agenda decision that basically says the question per se won't be answered in an agenda decision.
Thank you, Sue. And maybe I'll just then remind everyone that those last two tentative agenda decisions, so non-refundable VAT and also the on the topic of IAS 32 and warrants, are out for comment at the moment, and they're still out for comment until near the end of May. So if those topics are of interest to you, then we'd encourage you to send comment letters. So maybe moving on now, other than committee meetings, there were actually some other narrow scope amendments that the board has issued during the first quarter in the year. So again, Sue, perhaps I'm going to ask you to explain those narrow scope amendments.
Okay, sure. So the first one is about accounting policies and accounting estimates. And this actually started its life as a question that came to the Interpretations Committee. So it's very much an amendment that's designed to support consistent application. And the amendment in IAS 8 sets out a new definition of accounting estimates and provides a clearer distinction between what is a change in accounting estimate and what is a change in an accounting policy. And that matters a lot, of course, because those changes are accounted for in different ways when you apply IAS 8. The second amendment is one to IAS 1, and it's to do with accounting policy information. So the amendment is to require an entity to provide material accounting policy information. Previously, IAS 1 talked about requirements to disclose significant accounting policies. So we now explain as well in the materiality practice statement what this assessment might look like. And essentially, entities are required to provide entity-specific information that focuses on how an entity has applied IFRS standards to its own circumstances and focuses on the materiality of that information for users of financial statements. Both of these amendments, the one to IAS 8 and the one to IAS 1, are effective for annual reporting periods beginning on or after the 1st of January 2023. The third amendment is one that the board proposed and completed in a very quick time frame. It relates to COVID-19, and it's an amendment to extend the application of the practical expedient that was introduced into IFRS 16 last year to help lessees that are entering into particular COVID-19 related rent concessions. You might remember that the original practical expedient applied to rent payments that were originally due up until the 30th of June 2021. And we heard from stakeholders that now, because COVID has gone on longer than we had all hoped, that these rent concessions are being extended. And reflecting that, the board has extended the length of the practical expedient that was developed by 1 year. So now it is available for rent concessions that reduce lease payments due up until the end of June 2022. And that amendment is available immediately. So hopefully helpful relief for people trying to deal with accounting issues during this difficult time.
Great. Thank you very much, Sue. That actually brings our podcast to a close this time, shorter than usual, but I can already tell listeners that there will be some exciting topics to talk to you about when we record our podcast for Q2. So thank you all very much for listening. Thank you, Sue. We hope you found it useful, and please email communications@ifrs.org if you have any suggestions for improvement. So take care. Thank you and goodbye.